You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Leonard Binardo with the Open Society Foundations, director of the Open Society Fellowship. It's a pleasure to be here to celebrate and discuss, I hope critically and thoughtfully, Alex Cooley's new book, Great Games, Local Rules, with a subtitle actually not below the title, but above it, The New Great Power Contest in Central Asia. Alex, as many of you know, was a fellow with us at the Open Society Foundations a few years ago. In fact, one of our very first fellows with the Open Society Fellowship. Those of you who are interested, by the way, in the Open Society Fellowship, by all means, please take a look at our website on the Open Society Foundations website. But Alex is the Tao Professor of Political Science at Barnard College of Columbia University, and Great Games and Local Rules is his fourth academic book. It's a great pleasure as well to have the editor of Foreign Affairs, Gideon Rose, as our moderator, and we thank him very much for the opportunity. I don't know if Gideon actually has presented here in the past at the Open Society Foundations. But Stephen Kotkin, a very old friend, certainly has, and it's a pleasure to have him here, the Rosengarten Professor of Modern and Contemporary History, and the vice at Princeton University, and also the vice dean of the Woodrow Wilson School. We will take Q&A at a point, Gideon, I guess, that you think makes sense. And it would be great for those of you who do raise questions or comments to introduce yourself first. So let me welcome everyone again to the Open Society Foundations, congratulate Alex again on his new book, and please take it away, Gideon.
Thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be here for two reasons. The first is to celebrate this extraordinary book by this extraordinary scholar. It's really a very, not just an important subject, but the quality of research, and more importantly, perhaps, or as importantly, the cast of mind, sort of thoughtful and reasonable and comprehensive and sober, really is exactly what the kind of subject deserves and all too rarely gets. And that's really a fantastic accomplishment, which we'll hear more about in a bit. The second reason is I owe a deep personal debt of gratitude to Alex, and we'll be working it off in many ways, this being one of them. There's a story told about a man at a funeral who, as he's walking out of the cemetery, passes another mourner at a grave, weeping and gnashing his teeth and screaming, "Why did you die? Why did you die?" And he goes over to the man and comforts him and says, "I'm really sorry for your loss. Was the deceased someone particularly close to you, a relative or a friend?" And the mourner says, no, actually, I never met him." And he goes back, "Why did you die? Why did you die?" And the guy walking says, "I'm a little bit surprised. If you never met him, you didn't know him, why are you so upset with him for having left us?" And the man, prostrate man, looks at him and says, "He was my wife's first husband." I felt that way a lot about Kim Martin, who was my wife's predecessor as the chairman of the political science department at Barnard. And I have long said to her, "Why did you leave? Why did you leave?" And we have been waiting desperately with bated breath in my household for somebody to take the baton from my wife, Sherry Berman. And Alex, as of, I believe, is it now or in the fall? Is it already now?
Yeah,
Alex is the new chair of the political science department at Barnard College of Columbia University. And there is nobody happier about that than the Rose Berman household, who no longer have to deal with those things. Look, come on, you got a real political scientist, you got a real regionalist. I'm here for comic relief, so if I'm not giving that, then we're really in trouble. Okay.
Do we have time for questions?
Yeah, well, not yours. We're going to have Alex talk a little bit about the book, and we're going to have some color commentary by Kotkin, and then we'll turn it over for some real questions for you all, and hopefully have a good discussion. So without further ado, Alex Cooley.
Thanks so much, Gideon, and thanks to Gideon and Steve for joining me on the panel today. just the obligatory thank yous, but they are sincere and necessary. Many thanks to the fellowship program, to Lenny, to Steve, to Bipasha, for really taking a chance with this. And I know the project's evolved beyond its original scope and hopefully in a way that's thought-provoking. And thank you also to Barnard and to Columbia's Harriman Institute for supporting parts of this project. What prompted me to write this? As events in post-Soviet Central Asian region were transpiring throughout the last decade, I would continuously, especially in newspaper commentary, see references to the old great game, the old 19th century competition between Britain and Russia over sort of Central Asia and access points to Afghanistan and India. And this would be the lens through which most contemporary regional relations in Central Asia would be viewed at. So when there was a revolution in Kyrgyzstan, for instance, on 2005, the U.S. was up, Russia was down. 2010, U.S. was down and Russia was up. And this was very much the kind of zero-sum mentality we saw things in. And what struck me about this, and of course I'm being a little disingenuous because I approve the subtitle of the book, sort of, you know, Great Games, Local Rules, and it wasn't just OUP marketing. But what struck me about it was that being lost in this look back was Central Asia as a contemporary arena for world politics and what I call sort of multipolar politics. Some people have coined the term post-Western politics. That really, when we looked at some of the dynamics in Central Asia, the way that the U.S. military was securing access, the rise of China, the backlash against NGOs, the backlash against human rights, these struck me as very contemporary issues that we were seeing in other parts of the world, not in any way 19th century dynamics. And so with that broad kind of distinction that Central Asia is a window into contemporary politics as opposed to previous imperial politics, I really want to lay out three main arguments for you today. The first argument concerns the fact that the three great powers that I see in this contest, and so you noticed on the posters, the dragon, the bear, the eagle, are actually not really locked in competition. They're in rivalry, for sure, but they actually want very different things from Central Asia. For the U.S., Central Asia has been treated, especially after 9/11, as an appendage to the war in Afghanistan. So the U.S. has wanted bases, it's wanted supply lines, it's wanted transit hubs, and it has pretty much had to pay off Central Asian elites to obtain them, be it in the form of fuel contracts or transit fees or other types of quid pro quo. So Central Asia has been a means to conducting the war in Afghanistan, which has led to some interesting paradoxes that we could perhaps get into in the Q&A about governance and state building. China, too, has viewed Central Asia as a means to stabilizing an adjacent area, in this case, its western province of Xinjiang. Since 2001, China has concluded border agreements with the Central Asian countries, moved to try and upgrade the infrastructure in the region through its development assistance, cooperated with security services in the Central Asian states to manage what it calls the Uyghur splittist problem. Others would refer to it as a nationalist or autonomous movement, as well as also moved on Central Asian energy. Some of it, in terms of oil and gas for use in Xinjiang itself to power some of this development, but in the case of natural gas to be exported all the way to the east of China to fuel China's economic development. Its preferred instrument has not been sort of bases and transit agreements and contractors, but has been the creation of a new style international organization, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Based in Beijing, it's a new style organization that claims doesn't interfere in the affairs of its members, that it celebrates diversity and pluralism in international relations, and it counters and opposes Western hegemony and U.S. hegemony in these spheres. So it's relied on this kind of multilateral, I would say, veil for a lot of its bilateral initiatives. Russia, when we come to Russia, which is more problematic because I don't have a pithy line about what Russia wants in the same way that I do China and the U.S. From the most that I can find, Russia's obsession with Central Asia is really driven about status and with concerns about its status. It wants to be regarded as the privileged power. It wants to speak on behalf of the Central Asians, because in some ways this is what gives it a seat at the table as a global power. And you see this play out in very different ways. Post 9/11, then President Putin sees the opportunity to partner with the West as the way to enhance Russian prestige and try and cement Russia's importance in the world order. When the relationship starts degenerating, then Russia perceives Western bases, Western forays into Central Asian politics as a threat. Its relationship becomes much more competitive. So it goes back and forth. Its relationship with China, as Steve knows better than anyone, is extremely problematic. Bobolo has termed this an axis of convenience, not a real strategic partnership. And yet there are elements of cooperation and competition in the Chinese relationship to Russia, too. But for the most part, these three powers have coexisted. Their activities have intensified over the last 10 years. But for the most part, these agendas have coexisted. The second major argument I want to make is the one about local rules. What are Central Asia's local rules? How do they structure rules of the game? And this is another way in which I think sort of contemporary Central Asian politics really differ from the great games. The 19th century great game had actors who were acted upon, who were gobbled up, in some ways conquered, in some ways liaised with. Contemporary units are nation states, poor and weak in the case of Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, a little richer in the case of Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, perhaps Turkmenistan. But nevertheless, independent sovereign entities. And that has allowed them great influence and a sense of learning how to deal, how to negotiate with this external rivalry and external interest. So what are some of these local rules? First is that Central Asian governments conflate external security threats with internal security threats, right? So they are as concerned with transnational Islamic jihadist movements as they are human rights organizations that might actually sort of subvert the rule, especially in the wake of the so-called colored revolutions that deposed governments in Georgia, Ukraine, and Kyrgyzstan. So this conflation of internal and external threat. Second local rule is the use of public office for personal gain. And you see this, some refer to this as Central Asia's governance problem, corruption problem, but you see this on the international level. And I think both of these tendencies are illustrated in one of the chapters of the book where I describe Kyrgyzstan's base bidding war. So Kyrgyzstan's a very small, impoverished country. It's the host to the Manas Air Base, through which every U.S. service member going to Afghanistan is transited through. In February 2009, President Bakiyev announced that he would be closing the base, that the base was quite unpopular and the people have had their say. In fact, Bakiyev had been given a $2 billion payoff, or Ambassador McFaul called it a bribe, from Russia, which actually 1.6 of that was in promise of investment, but 300 million in loans and 125 in soft loans, to close down the base. That Russia was very displeased with it. So the U.S. behind the scenes opens negotiations, extends a no-bid fuel contract to the current offshore company that was providing fuel, and then decides to increase the rent to $65 million a year. And now we know from certainly a Global Witness report that was just published that, in fact, these monies, both from Russia and from the U.S., landed in offshore bank accounts that were controlled by or affiliated with the Bakiyev. So this is an example of real geopolitic hubris, right? This creation of the Central Asian bazaar, playing the Americans off the Russians in this base bidding war, really for the benefit of this small family.
The Blagojevich of Central Asia.
That's right, yes. And with very much the subtlety of the Blagojevich. Absolutely. The third general argument I want to put on the table, and it's not surprising from the first two, and those of you familiar with the region won't be surprised either, is that as a result of both this intensified external interest and the sovereigns digging in with the local rules, you've seen what I call normative regression in the region, a backlash against Western values, parts of the open society agenda, as you have it here. And this has come in several different flavors. One, an attempt to curry favor with these regimes, has allowed or has led governments to either applaud them in some of their more hardline tactics, such as the Uzbek government's clampdown on demonstrators in Andijan in 2005, where the Chinese and the Russians strongly backed this the Uzbek regime's killing of about 700, 800 demonstrators. But it's also prompted the U.S. to ease off on the human rights conditions, the political conditions. The U.S. Obama administration in February just waived the ban on sales of foreign military financing and military equipment to Uzbekistan as a quid pro quo for needing Uzbekistan for its new logistics and supplies networks. So an attempt to curry favor with regimes has certainly played against the value agenda. But you've also seen more, I would say, interesting and novel phenomenon. The rise of alternative institutions and actors. Institutions that mimic the form of Western institutions or traditional institutions, if not the substance. So for instance, alternative election monitors. It used to be the case that really the main election monitoring game in town was the OSCE's ODIHR's mission. And they would go to these countries and promptly look at the election and declare it to be not free and fair at a press conference and so forth, until Central Asian countries started to become really annoyed that there was this constant criticism over their lousy elections. And so what we see over the last, really since 2005, we have two new groups, the SCO-led, Chinese-led election monitors, and the CIS, Russian-led election monitors, who interestingly enough reach the opposite conclusions about the quality of Central Asian elections than the ODIHR counterparts. We see the rise in Chinese development assistance, right? I don't even call it development assistance because it's a mix of investment, loans, assistance. It defies these kind of ODA categories that we have, packages, as they're known. And again, no governance provisions or coordination with other lenders. And my sort of anecdote about this in the book is China paid 90% of the cost of a new road from Dushanbe to Chanak in Tajikistan. This is wonderful for the Tajik people. Goodness knows Central Asia needs an upgrade in infrastructure, no matter who does it. Then just a few days later, toll booths emerge on the road. And a company called Innovative Road Solutions, with apparent affiliations to the presidential administration, rakes in a revenue stream, local reporters estimate in the realm about $40 million a year as a result. So as a result of these $6 tolls, who can use the road? Well, you know, expats can use the road, foreign aid officials, and you know, drug runners, pretty much. But ordinary Tajiks can't use that particular road. So I think that's, not that I want to become an apologist for the World Bank and its conditions and so forth, but that's an important caveat. Finally, we see the human rights situation deteriorating, I would say, in disturbing and novel ways. I know of no other region, and there's a section of this in the book, where you've had three great powers conducting renditions in the name of sort of counterterrorism in the same region. That we saw the CIA rendering suspects back to Uzbekistan, or CIA contractors, perhaps more accurately, rendering suspects back to Uzbekistan. We've seen accused Islamists, Hizb ut-Tahrir, being rendered from Russia, as well as political dissidents to Central Asia, and we've seen Uyghurs rendered from the region to China, and against, you know, prevailing asylum laws and even national extradition procedures as well. We've also seen techniques of blacklisting, log rolling, that is sort of countries trading which extremist du jour they want on a consolidated list. And overall, this has had a pretty damaging effect. And I think, you know, the number one kind of indicator of this is that Central Asia as a region has become divorced from the post-communist sphere, I think, in parlance. If you talk to sort of Washington or Brussels about some of these issues, they kind of raise their arms in the air and say, that's Central Asia, what do you expect, right? There's no more the standards that, you know, we expect to say of the Czech Republic or Hungary, will they be applicable to Tajikistan. So in conclusion, I would argue that this heightened external interest, with this growing savviness and defensive of Central Asian regimes is really eroding the traditional tools of Western influence, whether it's in the area of rule of law, NGOs, development assistance, norms. And I make a very superficial attempt to apply this argument to the post-Arab Spring Middle East, because that's what everyone in IR is doing now. But I would suggest there are some interesting similarities. The U.S. position on Bahrain, for instance, reminds me of U.S. position in Uzbekistan, where a military base and military asset actually leads the U.S. To remain silent on a lot of important human rights issues. The fate of foreign NGOs in Egypt and the Middle East. Now, of course, OSF read the tea leaves before the crackdown there, but organizations like Freedom House and NDI did not. And one wonders why, given that what happened in Uzbekistan in 2005, what happened in Russia in 2006, was a replay of this meme that somehow NGOs constituted foreign interference in domestic affairs, and their role would be scrutinized, criminalized, if not more. So I think, you know, that's sort of another dimension of this. The rise of alternative mediators and lenders. You know, some wonder whether, you know, Qatari finance, right, may displace IMF and World Bank financing. Well, we haven't seen it yet, but the promises have been there. But we have seen financing from the Gulf to bolster the Tunisian economy, to bolster certain Salafi movements in Egypt in a way that exceeds the democracy promotion lending from USAID and so forth. So I just want to conclude with a couple of just observations. It's become very fashionable to talk about the post-Western world, and here I am doing it, and the rise of the BRICS. And in terms of also signaling greater diversity in the world, that, you know, the world is ripe for a democratization of its values, of the ways that it does things, of its institutions, that perhaps really the West doesn't have a whole heck of a lot to point to in terms of successes, and that maybe this is a good thing. Charles Kupchan has just written a really interesting book called No One's World, where he talks about you know, the decline of the West, but also the inability of anyone else to pick up the void in the slack. And he talks, his prescription in the book is that moderating on the values issue, these core human rights, democracy, governance issues, needs to take place if we're going to make the system more inclusive. What he recommends is that the U.S. engage with states that demonstrate responsible governance, no matter what their regime type. I think, I don't necessarily disagree with that in terms of the long-term prognosis, but I think what Central Asia teaches us is that this interaction between self-interested elites on the one hand and external actors with their other agendas are always going to take this meme of diversity and I think translate it in ways that serves the political status quo and the political interest. And so I think one of the questions that a network like OSF has in front of them is how possible is it to counter that, or is it desirable to counter that when, you know, basic kinds of institutions or longstanding practices have these alternatives or these challenges sort of towards them. So I've gone on longer than the 10 minutes I said I would take up, but I'll leave it there.
Such a bleak talk. Do you have anything cheerful to say?
Yeah.
Really, do you have anything cheerful to say?
The Kazakhs are part of UEFA now?
Okay. For a rebuttal, we turn to Steve Kotkin.
Am I allowed to go up to the Madeleine Albright podium?
You can.
Hello. Let me add my praise for the book, Mr. Editor and Mr. Chairman. The book is nicely researched, well argued, and on an important subject. Having said that, it's now kind of my responsibility to take him seriously, show my respect, and offer some challenges. Let me begin by saying that his version of the book slightly differs from my version of the book. I believe there are two principal arguments in the book. which he didn't really elucidate, but I'll give it a try. The first principal argument, in my view, is that there is no region known as Central Asia. I think the book is very persuasive on this point. There are a number of countries that have what I would say trilateral relations or quadrilateral relations, depending on how you want to evaluate the various different relationships to China, Russia, and the U.S., and they don't really have relations with each other. Not to the same extent. They don't see their strategic interests as interrelated. They see their strategic interests as playing off the larger outside powers and getting what they want. I think that's the first and really big argument in the book, that we don't really have a region, although we tend to treat it that way. And in fact, the larger outside powers keep telling the Central Asians to get their act together and to integrate and coordinate, and they're not interested. Second important argument in the book, in my view, is that we have a kind of reinvention of authoritarianism. There is what he called, and I agree, a savvier authoritarianism at play in Central Asia. They don't necessarily do a great job. They're not necessarily the most amazing, sophisticated authoritarians of all time. But nonetheless, they're learning, and they're improving, and they're figuring out how to do things like substitute their own election monitors. In other words, instead of just opposing outside election monitors, you put in your own, who are going to say what you want. And you can do that up and down the line. I could elaborate, but nonetheless, I believe that this is a very important argument of the book, the reinvention of authoritarianism. We won't go too far with that, but there's something to it. And then, as I said, the absence of a region. So anyway, that's my read of the book. Let me now offer four bullet points. The first is on the so-called great game. It's one of those things. It's just inevitable. It's inescapable. You can't really seem to avoid this nonsense. What was the great game? Russian power expanded, primarily by accident, into the wastes, as the Russians called it, of Central Asia in the 19th century. The British went hysterical. And the thing about the British is that they can write in the English language. And so they wrote literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books and pamphlets about Russian expansionism. They wrote about how the Russians were taking over, threatening India. Imperial Russian troops wanted to cleanse their feet on the shores of the Indian Ocean, threatening the crown jewel in the British Empire. Of course, it was just that, hysteria. Book after book, pamphlet after pamphlet, great game. The British and the Russians never actually came to blows. In fact, the idiotic Russian elites fought on the side of the British in the First World War, giving us Bolshevism. They were on the same side. Nonetheless, we have this great game stuff. Russian power in Central Asia barely existed. There were a couple of garrisons, usually across the way from the ancient settlement or the Muslim town. The Russians extracted almost no resources, were unable to govern or police. The only place that had a substantial population in Central Asia at the time, the Ferghana Valley, which in 1900 had 2 million people. The Russians had 59 administrators for the 2 million people in the Ferghana Valley, and two of them were translators. So they had one translator per 1 million people in the Ferghana Valley. That was Russian rule in Central Asia. I could give you some of the details, but then again, you can imagine them. And so the British hysteria over Russian power in Central Asia, which produced all these books and pamphlets, never really involved a struggle over resources, a struggle over influence. There were no pipelines going across the border. Anyway, so now we actually have a great game. The irony of the situation is that the hysteria of the 19th century, which produced the term, here in the 21st century, there is a serious rivalry. A rivalry over tangible goods and resources. Now, it's Alex Cooley's argument that it's not a zero-sum rivalry. This is actually very smart. It's one of the many smart aspects of the book. One of the many. So that in the competition, each side can get their piece or cut their deal. And they don't necessarily have to squeeze the other side out to get what they seem to want. So in fact, there really is a great game right now. It's just not necessarily zero sum. Bullet point number two, Chinese power. Chinese power in the world. I dare say that we're really trying to figure this out, aren't we? Is there a grand strategy in Beijing or not? Are they improvising? Are they merely reacting? Do they have ad hoc decision-making or even the absence of decision-making and just getting lucky? Or is there some type of driving grand strategy behind Chinese policy as exhibited in this particular region, for example, and elsewhere? The book doesn't provide an answer to that question, nor do I think does the academy or the punditry provide an answer to that question. However, there are certain things worth pointing out. One, which interests are we talking about when we use the word Beijing? The book doesn't really differentiate Chinese power. It doesn't talk about which agencies in China are for which policies and which are at cross purposes to those policies. In other words, China is obviously not a policy monolith. They have many different agencies at play here. And if China has a grand strategy, a question we haven't answered yet, it could be that it has more than one and that they're at cross purposes depending on which institution in China we're talking about. Chinese power in the world is a story in the book, but it's not fully differentiated, nor is it fully specified. If we widen the horizon a little bit on Chinese power in the world, we see that China borders on 20 countries. It has the most complex geopolitical environment in the history of the world. It doesn't border on Canada, Mexico, the Atlantic, and the Pacific. That would be what I would call an uncomplicated geopolitical environment. In fact, if we were choosing up, I would pick that one if I had first choice. China instead has 20 borders. Moreover, more than Russia, more than India, more than any other country. Moreover, those borders touch on very different kinds of places, regimes, and histories of interrelations. I'll give you just one example in addition to the Central Asian piece. China has no California. This is a really big problem if you're one of the rulers of China. Their western border goes into the sand and the mountains. There's no western coast of China. Now, there was going to be a western coast of China, and it was called Burma. And they were building tremendous infrastructure projects across Burma onto the Burmese coast, where they were going to build the ports, giving themselves access direct to the Indian Ocean. It was a great idea, and it looked like it was working. And they squeezed the Burmese too hard. And the Burmese government released a couple of prisoners. And there was Hillary Clinton. Because that's how it's done. You release a dissident or two. You announce that there's going to be an election. And there they come, ka-ching, ka-ching, and they're ready to deal with you again. I'm telling you, authoritarian regimes are not as stupid as they used to be. And so that was the end, temporarily, of China's California. Anyway, You could then analogize this, North Korea and the northern border, Mongolia, obviously, the Russian border in the north, all of Southeast Asia and the South China Sea. And so the Central Asian piece on Chinese power in the world, which is the piece that's well covered in this particular book, opens up into this wider horizon of China's complex geopolitical environment, which I would say is related to this question of, do they have a grand strategy or are they improvising? They could well have a grand strategy in relation to some of their neighbors and be improvising in relation to others. Let me switch now to bullet point number 3, if I may, Russian power in the world. It's been a longstanding point of mine that the primary metaphor for Russian power in the world is stepping on a rake. Russia vociferously gritting its teeth, puffing its chest, steps harder and harder on that rake. It's not clear what the ultimate purpose is. It's not clear what even the short-term benefits they're looking to get are. But they want to be heard. They want to be taken seriously. And if you don't, they're going to step right on that rake. And they're doing the same thing, in my view, in the book, as Alex Cooley demonstrates. Russian power in the world is very confused. They refuse to be the junior partner to the United States. Absolutely, under no circumstances will we be the junior partner to the United States. We will not be second fiddle in an American-dominated world. Therefore, we have to be the junior partner to Chinese power. And we have to give away everything we can to the Chinese in order to spite the Americans. And you see that rake, ba-boom, ba-boom, as they allow China to get its way, including in Central Asia, because it's denying the Americans what the Americans seem to want, although the Russians are not always sure even about that. So Russian power in the world comes out not looking too smart in the book, and so there's no real question, does Russia have a grand strategy or is it improvising? Which is a question that's unanswered in the Chinese case and not necessary to pose in the Russian case. Some people in this room, however, may disagree on the Russian question. And so perhaps we'll entertain that in the question period. Finally, the issue of U.S. power in the world, fourth bullet point. Here I would defer to Gideon Rose, and so I'll offer very few comments on this particular point, except to say that U.S. power in the world is awesome. It's incredible. I study a lot of history. I teach the course, you know, global history since Genghis Khan. And there's never been anything like U.S. power in the world. The test of U.S. power in the world is that it can do the stupidest, absolutely most stupidest things and slough it off, which we've seen just in the past couple of years. Small states, they don't have that room to maneuver. Small states can't make mistakes. They have to be very wise because they can get trampled among the big elephants. But big states can make mistake after mistake after mistake and endure and live to talk about it another day. That's how I would characterize U.S. power in the world. The Chinese have figured out that geopolitics 101 is not that difficult. It comes to the following proposition. If you oppose U.S. power in the world, you pay exorbitant costs. It's just very, very expensive to directly oppose U.S. power in the world. You can ask the Germans, you can ask the Japanese, you can ask the Soviet Union, and you can ask the Russians today. The other side of the equation of geopolitics 101 is that it can be very, very beneficial to seem to be aligned with U.S. power in the world. they can do a lot of your work for you, and you can sneak your agenda in there in non-zero-sum fashion. And I believe that the Chinese have a version of this, and the Russians really don't. And this differentiates them. U.S. power, however, U.S. power, we can ask the same question about whether there's a grand strategy or improvisation. Once again, I'll defer to my other panelists on this one, except to pose the question. Now, finally, let's end on the Central Asian stories. So, international relations produces 50 books in a row about two big states having some type of rivalry and competition. And each one tries to reframe how that competition is working between the two big states. And then the 51st book comes along and says, you know what? The little states in between the big states, they have agency too. And that agency, they manipulate, they push, they get what you want, they have their own agenda, they play one off against the other. And then international relations goes back and we get 50 more books about the two big states having a rivalry. And then again, that 101st book or 102nd book comes along, and it turns out that those little states, they have agency. This is one of those books. This is that 51st book or that 102nd book where it turns out, hey, those agents in between the big states, they have a lot of power. They don't have the power to determine the agenda always, but they have the power to sometimes get what they want inside the larger agenda. So my final point on this 51st, 102nd book is how enduring might this be? You see, because U.S. power in the world, great as it is short. It doesn't have much of an attention span. How long we now stay engaged in Burma, slowing the Chinese building of a California, is unclear to me. How long we remain engaged at all in the Central Asia non-region, as Alex Cooley shows, I'm not sure either. And so I'm not sure that the triangle or quadrilateral, or if you put the local agent into the picture, persists going forward. It could well be that there's a longer-term secular trend about Chinese power in this particular region, and that once the U.S. power loses its attention or gets distracted by something else, that the Chinese-Russia equation shifts also as a result. Thank you.
Steve Kotkin, folks. He's here all week. You can also catch the 9 and 11 o'clock shows.
Let me take the first question myself, and then I'll throw it over to you guys. Play off something that Steve said about the new authoritarianism or the revived authoritarianism and what you said about U.S. power. And I guess my query to you, Alex, would be, what is going to happen to political development in these Central Asian countries as the U.S. turns its attention away? You know, there's this old line about Mexico, you know, so far from God, so near to the United States. And in some ways, the story of your book, or one of the stories in your book, is that over the past 10 years, this massive U.S. engagement and involvement, unprecedented engagement with Central Asia, has been really crappy for many of the actual Central Asians, which wouldn't be terribly surprising. But, you know, for those of us who like to think of U.S. power and influence as a good thing with benign effects, in fact, if you're interested in military bases and other things, you actually make a lot of nasty compromises. So yeah. Now we see the end, the winding down of the wars. And to your point about U.S. power, you don't have to have U.S. power diminishing in general to have U.S. power no longer focused particularly on Central Asia. And I think that's clearly... There are two kinds of regions in the world for U.S. foreign policy. They're the ones that episodically come into view when there's a particular crisis, and then there are ones that become central foci of U.S. power and attention. Western Europe, you know, and then you have things switch into one category or another depending on world politics. Everyone in the world in American foreign policy knew about the Balkans during the 80s.
Everyone knew about Central America. Sorry, everyone knew about Central America during the 80s. Everyone knew about the Balkans during the 90s. Nobody, frankly, gives a damn about Central Asia or Central America or the Balkans in U.S. foreign policy circles today in policy terms. Now everyone's on Central Asia, South Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and so forth. In the next decade, is that, you know, as the war in Afghanistan winds down, I would predict that U.S. foreign policy will no longer focus nearly as intensely. Now, the question to you is that going to be a good or a bad thing for Central Asia? Certainly the influence of places like the OSF and NGO things are good. But is U.S. foreign policy helpful or hurtful? You know, do you want to be do you want to have us playing a role? And if we don't play a role, will that help or hurt the new, newly revived, clever, savvy authoritarians?
Right. So I think before we get to that stage, things are going to get even worse. And that's the Afghanistan withdrawal mode that we're going in. Because I think, you know, as much as the U.S. has instrumentalized its engagement with Central Asia over the last 10 years, I think you're going to press fast forward on that as the bureaucracies get into withdrawal mode, which means spending down budgets. It means giving the kind of assistance for withdrawal, like more border management, more predator drones, more engagement with actual security services on the ground to protect so-called shipments, without a care in the world, exactly because this is it. We're getting out. And the latest reports that somehow now the U.S. is involved with negotiations with Central Asian militaries over which equipment to leave behind, either because they're demanding it as a quid pro quo for agreeing to this reverse transit, or because it's just cheaper to do it that way. That, to me, is definitely another, you know, a rung even lower than the picture I've painted. Over the long term, I think you're right in the sense that the lack of U.S. spotlight on the region will mean, first of all, less global media prestige, which is something that these rulers all want, whether they're democratic or not, less limelight. And I think will intensify in some ways Russian-Chinese competition, perhaps India, if it was seriously engaged, which it's not yet. Arguments I make in the conclusion. So my short-term answer, which I think I know, is things get worse. My long-term answer is I think it cuts both ways. On the one hand, you know, because we don't have the sort of spotlight effects, the media effects, the sort of NGO engagement, that a lot of these sort of abuses or trends, can't be exposed. On the other hand, you're in a pretty tough neighborhood, and the two sort of perennial external powers are gonna sort of take up the slack, what they want to.
You have to pick a decade. In what decade in this century will you see the emergence of the first actual liberal democracy in Central Asia?
Wow. If I had to pick a decade, I don't think it's going to be before. My analogy here is Africa, which Central Asians hate being compared to Africa. But if you look at
Botswana.
But if you look at sort of, you know, the evolution of sort of, you know, post-colonial Sub-Saharan Africa and a lot of these sort of hegemonic states and going from the modernization paradigm in decolonization to building hegemonic parties to the collapse of international commodities markets, which sort of, you know, really disintegrates neo-patrimonial states, we're looking at 25, 30 years. So I would say, from independence. So maybe in an optimistic way it'd be sort of, you know, 2020s. But again, we only have experience of turnover in one place, Kyrgyzstan. And, you know, Kyrgyzstan has had some successes, not to minimize it, but it's, it was also heavily criticized by its neighbors for this democratic experiment. And I think, you know, one of the things I sort of show, Steve's absolutely right. I mean, you know, one of the chapters here is talking about the shadow of the region that doesn't exist, but it exists selectively, and it exists in terms of demonstration effects. So the Central Asians certainly don't want to cooperate with each other. They don't want to be part of some integrated European Union of Central Asia. But they're very concerned about what's going on in one another's countries. And so this sort of foray into parliamentarianism, short-lived foray as it's turned out, that really did, you know, pique the interest of the Kazakhs and the Uzbeks and the Russians, saying, you know, why are you experimenting in this? So that's also a headwind.
What's your answer? What decade? Liberal democracy in Central Asia. You're a cynic, so I'm curious about this one. Or next century.
You know, you call yourself a realist, so why do I have to be a cynic? You have two answers to your question. Two structural answers.
Ambrose Bierce defined a cynic as that blackguard who sees things not as they should be, but as they are.
Yeah. Well, then who's calling the kettle black here, dude? So you have the global energy regime. You scale me on a world scale, a non-hydrocarbon-driven automobile industry, and I'll talk about political change in Central Asia. And not only. And the other point is, you know, you tell me where you think Chinese power is going. Is China going to remain on a trajectory of great power status? And if so, is it going to remain a non-rule of law state? If the answer to both of those questions, yes, and if you don't give me a change in the global energy regime, you're not talking about the realization of the OSF agenda in the Central Asian states.
Okay.
That doesn't mean you don't try.
Okay.
Of course you try.
Okay, at that point, let's turn it over to you guys for your comments and questions. Please come to the fore, the microphone, or they're going to pass you the microphone and state your name and ask a nice succinct question so we can get as many in as possible. Sir.
You mentioned that if America and China has certain specific interest, Russia has only kind of struggle for prestige. I don't think so. Russia has very pragmatic interests there. And that's not just mineral resources to a certain degree, but first of all, Russia has no political correctness idiocy and liberalism idiocy about Muslim expansion in this region. They know very well it would not be democracy. It would be Wahhabism. It would be radical Islam there. And Russia really afraid much more than Europe afraid or America afraid of anything else. Even afraid more than China expansion to Siberia, which is empty. And talking about Chinese strategy, you don't need to be a strategist to understand that main hope for China, that's Siberia. And it fall being empty to their hands, one way or another.
Okay, so I'll leave the Siberia point to Steve if he wants to take it. But let me let me address the sort of the question of sort of strategy and material interests. Of course, there are specific interests that Russia has. I would call them more rent-seeking interests. You know, Gazprom had an interest in trying to ensure monopoly supply, which it failed. It failed to achieve. Not because of Nabucco or of Trans-Caspian or pipelines going to the West, because the Chinese just built a pipeline in 3 years from Turkmenistan across Uzbekistan up around Kazakhstan into China. So if that was the strategy, monopolize Central Asian gas, you know, Russia hasn't achieved that. It has certain material interests in that, yes, it would like to integrate the Central Asian military security services. It would like to try and mirror NATO by creating a CSTO, rapid reaction force. But it's a simulacrum, right? It's an attempt. See, I see the anti-terrorism issue. Yes, of course there are people concerned about militant Islam on the borders, but I'm not sure what Russia can do about it, A. And B, I see the Islam issue and the anti-terrorism issue as an excuse for Russia to pursue this reintegration with Central Asian militaries. And, you know, Putin's visit to Uzbekistan this time around mirrors his visit to Uzbekistan when he was first elected, an attempt to sort of bring the wayward child back into the fold precisely on this issue. So I think it's difficult to disentangle these things, but I don't see Russia having the same overarching grand strategic interest, single interest, the way the U.S. has in the case of Afghanistan, or the way China has in the case of Xinjiang.
You want to talk about Siberia? Because everybody always says that the Chinese are going to get Siberia, or it's empty, or they're going to take it over, or creeping immigration. Is that something that actually will be happening in the next generation or two?
We've been hearing for 20 years that the Chinese are coming to Siberia, and we will be hearing for 200 years that that's going to happen. So the Chinese focal points are, to repeat, Southeast Asia, which is where they determine their primary strategic interests lie, Burma and the Indian Ocean, and the Korean Peninsula. Those are areas of tremendous focus of many agencies inside China. Siberia does have great mineral wealth, and the Chinese are able to purchase that on the world market. A settlement in eastern Siberia and the Russian Far East is complicated. That's why the population there is declining. It doesn't hold them there. It's not as attractive even to those who were born there, let alone those from the outside. So China doesn't really have a big northern strategic interest beyond Northeast Asia, Korean Peninsula. Let's put it to you this way. The only reason the Chinese capital is Beijing, northern capital, which is what it means in Chinese characters, is because the Mongols put it there. The Mongols put the capital in the north because it was closer to the grazing fields of Inner Asia. Chinese capitals before the Mongols were usually in the south, where the people lived, like Nanjing, which is southern capital in Chinese characters. Where the monsoon is, where the wet rice grows, where the people live, where the ports are, etc. Beijing, if you've been there, is a tremendous dust bowl. And so the idea that they're going to continue that march farther north into very difficult ecological circumstances strikes me as not that likely. But once again, the issue is, you know, is this Chinese thing going to continue in the form it does? And I really think that, you know, that's the principal question in the world today that we're all trying to figure out. And we don't know the future.
Let me just address the China question, just because Steve brought up, I think, a very right-on-the-money critique about not differentiating Chinese interests and bureaucracies. And I think that's true. And, you know, it strikes me it's a mix of strategy and ad hoc. Right. I mean, you know, if you look at the sort of the Confucian centers and the way they're set up in China, it's almost this kind of, or in Central Asia, it's almost this type of franchising model, right? Where you open up a shop, and if you get enough customers, then you get more materials, more textbooks are delivered to you, then you get sort of more teachers trained and so forth. You know, that strikes me as quite decentralized. You know, I've heard from people who know the oil business much more that, you know, CNPC got the pipeline done very quickly because they were competing against other Chinese companies with an interest in it, you know, possibly. So the questions I don't know. What I wanted to show was the sort of power spreading empirically from the bottom up. That is, I think a lot of us in international relations, we're always obsessed with, you know, is China going to challenge U.S. hegemony sort of straight on, and sort of how would we know? And what's really impresses me, strikes me about China and Central Asia, there's very little of that talk. There's almost none of that talk in Central Asia. It's always deference to Russia. It's always win-win. It's always mutual trust and cooperation. It's very difficult for someone like me who doesn't even speak the language to penetrate what Chinese motives are. And I think that's also led Central Asian analysts to say, well, the Chinese aren't really interested in influence. The Russians are interested in influence. Chinese not so. But then you look at the empirical facts. You look at Tajikistan last year signing over almost 1% of its territory to China and saying it got a good deal. You know, we're grateful that they can take care of this mountainous region for us. You see the way they put the squeeze on Bakiyev 2005, who had run a Sinophobic election campaign, and the Chinese had no contact with him until he took the pledge on Xinjiang, Tibet, and the sanctity of previously negotiated border agreements. And the minute he did that, then he got his banquet in Beijing the following year. So, you know, what strikes me, you know, apart from the fact that it's very difficult to penetrate, is the way in which Chinese power is wielded. You know, it seems, you know, quiet, behind the scenes, you know, not drawing attention to itself, happy to deflect to either Russia or, you know, in some cases, the U.S., you know, the spotlight and international attention.
Yes, in the back here.
Hi, my name is Sarah McCune. I'm from Citizen Lab at University of Toronto. Congratulations, Alex, on your book. Just to pick up really quickly on the comment you made about China, I think you're definitely onto a very good point there. I think China's primary interest is domestic stability and consolidating that stability through co-opting the cooperation of external actors. So it's not so much, you know, extending outward as consolidating inward. I definitely agree with that. A couple questions. First of all, on the role of the CSTO, I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that. You spoke mostly about the SCO, and I was wondering if you have any comments on the actual practical influence of the CSTO on a day-to-day level within Central Asia. And then additionally, I was wondering if in your research you came across any information related to the sharing or transfer of technology. I think that whichever of the great powers or other countries actually provide the technology and the infrastructure that supports it, especially telecommunications infrastructure, yep, will have a significant influence in the region. So any comments you might have about that? Thanks.
Yeah, sure. So the CSTO, again, in terms of practical influence, I don't see too much of it. I see it more as a vehicle for certain private interests. So for instance, CSTO offers, you know, officer training, it offers, you know, various fora, it offers sort of simulations. It also offers discounted weaponry for a lot of these, you know, these militaries. But in terms of actual teeth, you know, you saw a very good test case in Kyrgyzstan in 2010 when inter-ethnic conflict violence broke out in the south, and then interim Premier Roza Otunbayeva appealed to Moscow, saying, please send paratroopers the way the Soviets did in 1990. Send the CSTO. Send anyone, right? We don't have any functioning capabilities of the state. What does the CSTO do? It sort of, you know, trots out this excuse that interfering in domestic affairs is outside of its mandate, right? So when push comes to shove, they didn't want to do it. The other big problem that the CSTO has is Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan simply won't sign on to any of the more concrete things they want to do, which is, you know, even led some in Russia to sort of wonder, would we be better off, would be more cohesive not having Uzbekistan in there? You know, in some ways strategically, I think that would be the smart thing for the Russians to do. I think the smart thing, if they truly wanted to do divide and rule, would be to become close with the Kyrgyz, become close with the Tajiks, invest in their hydro, stick two military garrisons there and tell Uzbekistan you can go play with the West. Right, then I don't know what the reaction would be. But the Russians want to do something that's structurally very difficult. They want to unite and rule, right? The logic of divide and rule is how you organize hierarchically because you pick sides in local conflicts. So having wanting Uzbekistan in, I think, is the real killer for the CSTO. I just don't think it's going to get any functional traction. And in terms of the technology, I think you see this now with Chinese versus Russian technologies in Central Asia. You know, my sense is the cybersecurity initiatives in the SCO, the surveillance and the monitoring technologies have been transferred to the Turkmen as Chinese. You know, that's part of the regional cooperation that, you know, you also documented in terms of what the SCO Regional Anti-Terrorism Center is doing.
Yes, here, sir. Okay. What part does oil play in all this?
Yeah, oil plays a significant part in some of the countries, the oil-rich countries. So it plays a significant role in Kazakhstan, plays a significant role in Turkmenistan, and a non-trivial role in Uzbekistan. Turkmenistan is often trumpeted as having the world's fourth or fifth or sixth largest resources of natural gas. What the Turkmens have done over the last 2 years is swap patrons. They used to pump gas into the Russian-led network that was going out west. Now they pump it to the Chinese. So China has replaced Russia as Turkmenistan's main patron. Kazakhstan is more complicated because it's led by a new style authoritarian who coined the phrase happiness is multiple pipelines, right? And this attempt to court the West.
Hallmark card
court,
in Central Asia, isn't
that's
it?
It's a great bumper sticker. To court the West, to court China, to court Russia without ever letting this fall out of balance. But China has still built a pipeline that extends across Kazakhstan and is taking these small, medium-range deposits, drip, 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 out east. So certainly that's the big engagement. That's the big U.S. material interest post-Afghanistan. And there's a little bit in the book about how the U.S. in the 1990s sought to access Kazakhstan's wealth and the so-called Geffen Affair and so forth.
Explain to me how you see the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan playing out.
Let's get these questions too, and then you can do both.
Yes.
I agree with the first gentleman's comments as far as talking about why the Russians would be involved. Also, I'd posit, my name is Malcolm Arnold, by the way. I'd also posit the Russians are being involved because if you don't have a strategy and you don't get involved, then you're acquiescing the fight. And so at some point you have to stay involved to make sure that you have a seat at the table, however it plays out. But as was mentioned earlier, is that, you know, Central America, the 80s, the Balkans in the 90s, there's something vastly different about this region. And it is makes it so that it's an incentive for all the Central Asian countries not to get along. And that is the oil question as far as oil. And that is going to be around for a long, long time. Central America, basically you have, you know, Panama Canal, that's about it, mostly. And you only have those countries that are there working as far as that. You've got the natural resources, and as long as the price of oil is at a certain level where it makes it worth being involved in that area, I think that they're going to be in that area. The question is that then how do you incentivize the Central Asian countries to work together so that in a way that is more collaborative and peaceful and more in line with human rights? Right now, I see that it is in their interest as far as the countries to continuously play off each other in a circular type of fashion, the other countries. And I want to know what your comments are on that as far as the oil question, as far as when that incentive drops out of the equation, you know, how do you go about addressing that and getting them to work together in a way that it, you know, actually, you know, goes along with the OSF agenda?
I think it's a very good question, but I think the premise of it is that somehow rulers will act in their national interest because they know they would nationally be better off if they cooperated with each other. That might be true. That's how standard international relations approaches to cooperation. Those are the assumptions they're based on. However, rulers themselves individually might not be better off cooperating. They might be better off keeping this regulation, keeping these barriers, what I call in the book borders as toll booths, because they offer these revenue streams for them, these private revenue streams. One other fact here, all of these are essentially one family, one extended family types of states. And so, you know, in patrimonial systems, you give positions and state authority in exchange for loyalty or belonging to the proper ruling circle. So why in the world would you want to integrate something, right? That's a prime political gift. And this is what I think the EU in its determination to get them to cooperate, whether they like it or not, also the Chinese, also the Russians, also the US, sort of miss here. that this is these positions that they want to integrate either in the telecommunications sphere, the energy sphere, the electricity sphere, are actual state monopolies that people who are connected to power make a lot of money off of. So that's, you know, that's my cynical sort of view as to why you're not going to see cooperation either in energy or in any of these other lucrative enterprises.
Okay, Afghanistan. How does the U.S. exit play out?
I think it plays out very badly as far as Central Asian states go. I think in terms of sheer transfers of, say, security assistance or economic aid, I think the Central Asian states will do as well and might even do better for a few years than they have done because we'll be in withdrawal mode, right? And what does withdrawal mode necessitate? It necessitates managing the border. It necessitates containing extremism. It necessitates protecting shipments, and it necessitates getting equipment out. All of these things are going to play into the hands of Central Asian governments and security services. The other component of this is that the U.S. has come up with this idea, along with the Germans, but really it was the U.S. idea, of creating the new Silk Route in Central Asia. And the new Silk Route is going to link up Afghanistan with Central Asia by investing in a lot of infrastructure projects. So we'll have even more projects. We'll have more bridges. We'll have more railways. We'll have more highways. And we're going to recreate the Silk Route because the one thing that Afghanistan needs post-U.S. is more commerce as opposed to aid. The problem with that, again, dealing with these patrimonial societies and these kinds of governments, is that you're actually liable to foster more competition over individual projects amongst these countries than you are an actual collective regional integration. In other words, the Tajiks are going to demand that the bridge go there. The Uzbeks are going to demand that the money comes here. So it doesn't solve the core issue of increasing regional commerce. In some ways, it's a slogan to make the State Department feel good or feel better about Afghanistan. Hey, the new Silk Route, we're leaving that. We're not leaving much else, but we're leaving the place in regionally a better place than it was before. The same thing with SCO attempts to, should the U.S. engage with it, should it not, that somehow the SCO is going to be the magic bullet that creates a regional solution for Afghanistan. How can it create a regional solution for Afghanistan when its basic members won't even agree about what to do in Afghanistan? So I think a lot of this is for PR show, and a lot of this is to sort of signal to the world that we care about Afghanistan's region.
Okay, that's actually the good news.
Yeah.
What if things actually go really down the tubes and you actually get outright civil war or failed state chaos in Afghanistan after the U.S. exit? What does that do to the region?
It can do a number of things.
Do you think that's going to happen?
Let's hope not. But then again, it is Afghanistan.
Yeah, I'm not as pessimistic on that. I'm pessimistic about a lot. I'm not as pessimistic on this, right? I mean, take the example of the Turkmen and the Taliban, right? They have this enormous border. During Taliban times, they reached a very informal understanding. You guys don't go over this border, and we'll pretty much leave you alone and in check. And so, you know, I think if everyone's on the same page in that way, I don't see what incentives any insurgents in Afghanistan have to take the fight to the actual Central Asian states themselves. Now, I might be wrong about this. It might be the case that, you know, a couple of dozen Uzbeks who've been, you know, in the northern tribal areas in Pakistan go back and wreak havoc. I just don't think so, though. I think the history there of sort of informal modus vivendi.
You had a question next?
In the 19th and 20th century, we saw the superpowers around the world dictate who owns what and what the national boundaries were. And I'm hearing and seeing in the book that you believe that's still going to play out in the future. And what the first gentleman was asking and what I'm asking is, who's addressing radical Islam on the march, and what is that going to do to the game?
Just talking a little bit.
Right. Yeah. So the radical Islam question—it's very interesting in terms of when you look at actual episodes involving radical jihadists in this part of the world, just the post-Soviet Central Asian states. There's really not that much, right? there's not that much given the amount of attention that's been paid to it, the amount of sort of resources, the amount of sort of inter-security cooperation meant to sort of snuff it out, that we haven't seen prolonged or sustained attacks. And in fact, the couple of incidents that we have from Uzbekistan, there's sort of reasonable debate over whether this was a put-on job by the Uzbek security services themselves. Now, let me flip that question, that if I were studying radical Islam in this part of the world, to me, all the ingredients for becoming a more radical jihadi are there, right? Oppressive authoritarian governments, corrupt, nepotistic, sponsored by outside powers. You can go down and, you can find sort of Shah's Iran without the glamour. So I think in that way, yes, there might be over the medium period, and maybe that'll butt up against the first kind of liberal democracy being sort of created in places in
maybe
the forgotten.
Maybe liberal Islamist democracy.
Maybe. But in some ways we're inculcating it, but so far it's been the sort of dog that actually hasn't barked, even though the Chinese, the Russians, and the U.S. have all engaged with Central Asia with that as the main pretext.
Do you agree with that? And if so, do you think, Steve, that the radical Islam is the contemporary analog of the British fear of Russian involvement, that you were talking about in terms of paranoia a century and a half ago?
So, between 1936 and 39 in Spain, there was a civil war. And internationally, it was defined as a battle between fascism and communism. And the Italians and the Germans, that is to say, fascist Italy and Nazi Germany, intervened on the side of Franco and the nationalists, and the Soviet Union intervened on the side of the Republicans or loyalists. But fascism had been nothing in Spain before 1936, and communism had been nothing in Spain before 1936. And lo and behold, there was no fascism or communism as the outcome of the Spanish Civil War either. And so just because there's the threat of radical Islam doesn't mean there's the possibility of radical Islam. It's just not a seed that necessarily grows everywhere we might fear it might grow. So I would be cautious about using terminology like radical Islam in this particular area, because the threat of radical Islam is an instrument of rule in the hands of the kleptocracies. So I don't foresee a strong ability of radical Islam to implant regimes in these particular places.
Explain a little bit. What is it that makes this particular ground stony for these particular seeds?
Yes, so the Soviet Union destroyed Islam in Central Asia, much more than Ataturk did in Turkey. They closed all the seminaries. The mullah class was unable to reproduce. The number of religious practitioners in the Soviet period were severely reduced. And when the Soviet Union ended, there were cultural, as there had always been, expressions of Islam, rituals of marriage, birth, and death, but there was no deep religiosity, and there still is not deep religiosity. So, in Ataturk's case, you have something quite different. You have an obvious attempt from above to secularize or to statize institutions, to take education away, for example, from Islam and give it to the secular state. But you also have a modernization program where you're bringing the village to the city. And the village came to the city over time in Turkey, and it came with the veil on. And now they want to wear the veil at the universities in Turkey. And that's the success of Turkish modernization, as it were, the transformation of a rural country into an urban country, but the rural came with its practices. In Central Asia, you have nothing like that, and you haven't had anything like that You have, however, the bogeyman of it, which the regimes use extremely effectively in all sorts of ways, creative ways in some cases. Now, you have religious practice, and in certain areas of Tajikistan, for example, you have deep religiosity. It's not necessarily political Islam. It's not necessarily Islamism. Moreover, political Islam is actually quite difficult. It's mostly a failure every time it's been tried. So I don't see it as the short or medium-term possibility in this particular region.
And two caveats to that. One is, from a socioeconomic demographic point of view, the sort of candidates to be radicalized and mobilized have mostly left the country, right? So over the last really 6 years, you've seen sort of 10 million Central Asians leave for economic opportunity, most of them in Russia. And they are of the age and of the demographic that typically get mobilized in other places. And politically, it's a smart move on the part of the regimes. I think, you know, one of the things that strikes me when you go outside of capital Dushanbe or Bishkek, more remote parts, is the absence of able-bodied young men. They're all gone. And that leads to one kind of safety valve there. I think the other point I would make is Iran's role in a lot of this was constrained by its relationship with Russia, right? A lot of people said, why hasn't Iran played around more in Tajikistan the way it did during the sort of civil war and back factions? Mainly because it needed Russia as a patron in this sort of counter-Western marriage of convenience that they found themselves in for a while anyway. And it realized that this was Russia's special place of privileged interest. So Iran actually hasn't sponsored any of the activities that one might think Iran would do in Tajikistan and so forth. So I think there's some, but I think, you know, the fundamental reasons are, as sort of Steve pointed them out, in terms of the Soviet legacy.
Over here.
I'm Nicholas Arena. I'm a lawyer. I made my living trying murder cases. In a murder case, we highly prize eyewitness testimony. As I leave this very learned discussion, I wonder what an individual from that part of the world that we've been hearing about would think about all this. A person that's really going to be affected in the future by all these discussions and by these different countries' interests.
How would they react then? And let me piggyback on that. There's a line in your introduction, I think, Alex, where you say, you know, I used to, in my first base politics and elsewhere, I used to see Central Asia as a series of cases against which I could test more general political science theories.
Right.
And now I've come to realize that it's an arena to generate interesting stories of its own that I can then take back and, in fact, infuse other debates in the field with. And this whole question, how unique is Central Asia, and how much in effect is local individual knowledge the key to understanding what's going on, and how much is it broader patterns that in fact you don't actually have to be an eyewitness to, or even a local expert with detailed knowledge of the languages and culture and history in question to understand? Is it the regionalist detail that is important to understand what's going on, or an understanding of politics in general, modernization, the resource curse, what have you?
It's a great question. And, you know, my own view on this is that in political science, I'm what's called a soft rational choice theorist. I'm not a modeler. I don't do that kind of stuff, mainly because I think I've studied Central Asia. Right? So I don't think I've started with the assumption of rationality. I think I've, you know, I've come to expect it, given the study of both Central Asia now and Central Asia during Soviet times. I mean, I think, you know, the important part of this was that the Soviet Union brought important changes in Central Asia, but it also brought a similar kind of resistance and coexistence, an attempt to graft Central Asian, I want to call them kinship networks, different sort of localized networks onto Soviet institutions like the collective farm or the regional, local sort of communist parties. So this sort of translation that Central Asian elites have always engaged in, it dates back to Soviet times, and even before, as sort of Steve pointed out, in terms of sort of Imperial Russia's bare bones management of it. In terms of sort of, you know, the local peculiarities, I don't know. I always sort of hesitate to say, you know, something is sort of sui generis. I mean, that's why I want to say sort of Central Asia may be sort of forward-looking as opposed to sort of distinct, right? You know, I see sort of, you know, dynamics of sort of AFRICOM, you know, in sort of CENTCOM and the sort of civilianization of sort of military life or sort of, you know, the economic payoffs it offers, for instance, and its engagement with locals. So I see really self-interested rational elites exerting their power, learning, using external resources in very savvy ways. You know, I think that's also true of other parts of the world. So what we say is sort of culturally distinct and unique. I think you have to be very careful and bound the issue that you're talking about in the legacy that's supposedly making something unique. But in terms of sort of raw politics, raw political survival, I'm not sure it's all that distinct.
What about you? You're a historian, but you talk sometimes like a political scientist, and you seem more of a fellow traveler than most of your historical colleagues. What do you think about this general specific dichotomy?
On the one hand, you've got a global phenomenon, which is the kleptocracy. You have an international system that privileges state sovereignty, and that privileging of state sovereignty often allows a small group of people to rip off everything in sight. And this is a phenomenon which is not specific to Central Asia. It's unfortunately a global phenomenon. There's all sorts of terminology for it, most of which is pretty good. State capture, Trashcanistan, which is not an ethnic term but a political term. Then you have some specific factors. This is the only region of the world where you have Chinese-Russian competition. The Chinese do not allow Russia anywhere else in Asia. There's a little bit of Russia on the Korean Peninsula, which the Chinese would like to get rid of. But in almost all forums of business that concern Asia, the Chinese are adamant that there are no Russian interests at stake and therefore no Russian representation necessary. In Central Asia, the Chinese are not able to do that. Moreover, it's not in their interest to do that, because my argument is that Russian activity in Central Asia facilitates Chinese expansionism. It's a game that the Chinese are going to want to play for a really long time until they don't need the Russian facilitation anymore, which could be coming sooner rather than later. So that's unusual. That's a regional specific thing, where you have Chinese and Russian power in seeming rivalry, non-zero sum, in Alex Cooley's terms, facilitation of Chinese expansionism, in my term. That's different. The other thing that's different is that this is a place where the U.S. goes to war. We've now fought, you know, we fought three wars in East Asia before we kind of got the hang of it. The first one was absolutely necessary. It was started not by us. The other two, there's debate about the extent to which the Korean War and the Vietnam War were necessary or not. You have your own views on that. I'm just saying that we fought three wars in East Asia, and there was a learning curve. And at the end of the learning curve, there was a kind of realization that it wasn't necessary to fight a land war in East Asia again. We're now on the learning curve phase in CENTCOM, or the area between kind of Turkey and East Asia. It depends how you count the Gulf Wars, whether it's one or two. And now we have the Afghanistan one. And we'll see if the learning curve is complete at this point, or we require another experiment to complete our learning in that particular area, as we did in East Asia. So that's also different. The U.S. doesn't fight a war in every single region of the world. And it has fought wars in this region recently, and it's not excluded that it could happen again. Now, so if we have a general phenomenon of the kleptocracy, you have the specificity of Russian power being in the game with China, in my view as a facilitator, and then you have the fact that Russia's America's fighting a war there. So take out the Russia fighting the war, take out the Russian facilitation of Chinese power, which may have a only so far left to go, and then you're left with the usual kleptocratic phenomenon that we see in many different places of the world. So that could be, it could become less distinct, as it were, over time.
I think the other aspect of this, in terms of being on the war footing, this is a region which for 10 years, CENTCOM has been on a war footing. And when you look at just the way sort of CENTCOM is structured, and you know, the OSF network has looked into some of this, Laura Lumpy's work and so forth, you see a lot of discretion in how this money is allocated, a lot of money for access, a lot of money for logistics, a lot of money to sort of grease the wheels. That's not considered official military assistance. And if you just look at some of the WikiLeaks in terms of how Petraeus is received in these countries, the briefings that he gets, the meetings that he gets, this is head of state type stuff. And so for 10 years, this has had consequences, on the ground consequences in terms of prestige, in terms of budgets. And I think the irony about Afghanistan in some ways is that, you know, most people agree that governance, the legitimacy of the Karzai regime, its appearance of sort of being corrupt and inept, that these are all the things that are impediments to successful state building in Afghanistan. Well, in the neighborhood, in order to assist this effort, we've encouraged all of those things through treating Central Asia as this appendage to the Afghan campaign. So this is curious behind the curtain kind of dynamic. Now, in terms of CENTCOM operational planning, the mission is Afghanistan. So everything else is peripheral, right? Whether it's Manas or whatever. But I think then we need to be honest and say, what have the costs been of Afghanistan? People talk about the costs in terms of Pakistan and the collateral damage. And I think the way that we treat Central Asia is also a related Afghan cost that isn't acknowledged.
Because everything was so hunky-dory before Afghanistan?
No. But I think, no, and then that's a very fair point to make, sort of the counterfactual, right? You know, what would democracy look like, corruption? But you see an intensification of these dynamics with external interest, and some of it quite unintentional, right? I mean, you know, we didn't intend to create all these problematic sort of fuel contracts or pay $500 million a year to the Central Asian country so we can just ship equipment to Afghanistan. But this is what happens in wars. You make stuff up. You reach ad hoc solutions. You have to, you know, cut sort of dirty deals. So the accumulation of that, I think, has taken its toll.
We're coming up on the witching hour, and I take away from this three emotions, depression, determination, and some little glimmer of optimism. The depression from the discussion we've been having and the subject matter and the issues in question. Determination for the work of groups like OSI and OSF, and the, you know, what we've seen here, I think, in this discussion is the inability of U.S. foreign policy and state actors to do a whole lot of good in the short term directly in terms of political development and liberalization and positive thing. And if that progress is going to happen in those areas on the ground in foreign countries, it's either going to be because of the locals themselves or because of the locals with the help of well-intentioned non-state actors like OSF. And that's where the work of this organization and this forum actually needed to be more and better, despite all the disheartening things. And then finally, the glimmer of optimism from the level of discussion and the quality of the analysis. I supposedly run the most prestigious foreign policy and global affairs magazine, and I wish that the stuff we run was as intelligent and clear and insightful as the material we've been hearing and talking about tonight.
Both of you have been authors. I hope you will continue to be authors in the future. And this really is a very special pair of people discussing things at an extraordinarily clear, high, and seriously minded level. And for that, we thank you. And Alex, congratulations on a great book.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
And thank you all. With that, we are adjourned.